Nobody ever asks how many you saved. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast where all the edits are clearly audible. Whether it's to immerse the viewer in the story, prove their auteur credentials, or simply, in the case of Russian ARC director Alexander Sukharov, you just don't like editing, filmmakers have been continually drawn to the challenge of making a single-take movie. Alfred Hitchcock was the first to give it a crack back in the 1940s with Rope, and more recently we've seen Sam Mendes with 1917 and Alejandro Iñárritu give it a go with Birdman. As you can see from the films I've mentioned, the directors who've previously taken on the considerable challenge of making a film in this fashion tend to be garlanded Oscar-worthy types, people who can bring to bear the full resources of a major Hollywood studio in making such a film. They don't tend to be jobbing DTV directors with little more than loose change to work with. But proving that stylistic ambition isn't just reserved for the Silver Spoon Brigade at the big studios is James Nunn, who, with his new film, has made a single-take action movie appropriately called One Shot. To help me review the film, I'm joined by a man who puts the perfect head into One Shot. It's Alex Rallo from One Perfect Headshot. Welcome back to the show, Alex.
Hi, Will. Happy to be back.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad that you're happy to be back because I feel like I've given you a bit of a rough ride on your previous appearances on this podcast. On the past episodes, I've asked you to assess the martial arts capabilities of Coolio or discuss the importance of toilet humor in the cinema of Wong Jing. So, I feel with this film, I've finally been able to get you to review a serious action film, especially as you're a serious film scholar.
Am I? Look, Eric, I always have time to discuss Wong Jing toilet humor. It's no problem. No problem at all. No, unfortunately, no toilet humor in this one. But good film. Despite
the absence of toilet humor. Yes, exactly. Now, we are reviewing One Shot. And before we get into this film, I guess I wanted to find out where you stand on directors employing the sorts of self-limiting techniques that we see in this particular film. Because I guess the easy criticism of a film like that, and it's not without foundation, is that it's just a gimmick. And if you're making a film, why deprive yourself of the options to make cuts, to shoot from different angles or contract the passage of time? On your Twitter feed, you love to extol the virtues of great editing. And here we have a director who's taking that completely out of the equation. So, yeah, I guess I wanted to know where you stood on directors employing limitations on themselves and, particularly this type of one-shot style of filmmaking.
Well, the gimmick filmmaking goes back, it goes all the way back to the 50s. You've mentioned the Hitchcock movie, of course, but there were other types of gimmicks at the time as well. There could be like experiences for the audience in the room. Like, I don't know if you know William Castle.
Oh yes.
The director who had like the vibrating seats or the skeletons appearing in the room. This kind of stuff. But yeah, the one-shot gimmick is more organic than all of those gimmicks we just mentioned, and therefore more suited to proper storytelling, I suppose. It's always risky, but it's always interesting because you can either really nail it or you can make something that's borderline unwatchable. And all of those movies that you've mentioned, the only one that's a real one take is the Russian ARC. And all of the other films we've mentioned are not real one takes. There have been other real one take films. We might mention them later, but One Shot is not a real one. And when we're talking action movies, I think it would be irresponsible to try to shoot an action film with explosions and firearms and hand-to-hand combat as a proper one take, so in a sense there is no editing, but in another there is, because you need to think, as the director needs to think, how to stitch together his shots in a seamless fashion, and that's a kind of editing. So I think, like, we've talked before a bit about those films. I don't think, what was it, Bushwick?
Yes.
Bushwick, I don't think
you
it's
know
a proper,
I'm a big fan of the Bushwick.
It's not a full one shot. There are cuts, right?
Yes, they are. Yeah, there are edits within the film. That's my understanding. Yeah, it's not a true one take.
But yeah, there was this in the action department. There was this. Some people consider Victoria, the German film, as an action film as well. I just mostly consider it as a boring film. actually, maybe that one is a true one take as well. Maybe actually, not sure, but yeah.
Wasn't there a recent like Japanese film where some guy was like fighting 1,400 assassins or something?
No, it's 400 and it's only 400, and it's it's actually that film. It's called Crazy Musashi, and the opening and the epilogue are traditional like scenes with edits in them, and the middle bulk of the film is a true one take. So there's like maybe, I don't know, there's like maybe 10 minutes of the film that's traditional filmmaking, and the rest is a one take. So it doesn't qualify because of that prologue and epilogue. But yeah, they did that, and it was insufferably boring. like, especially when you compare with the opening and closing scenes.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've seen the film, but
I have not.
The opening and the end are amazing, like proper good action scenes with great editing. And then you get the middle section where it's like, it's just too slow. It's just impossible to hide the logistical difficulties. So there are 400 against him, and like you can just see them like walking around him for 20 minutes before, you know, getting slashed and, you know, going off screen and coming back 10 minutes later as a new character. It's supposed to be happening, you know, like in the samurai era, and some of them are wearing like modern shoes, you know, this kind of stuff that it's difficult to hide, you know, like doesn't matter. I mean, it does matter how much you rehearse and prepare, but when you have no budget like that film, you know, it matters. And I think what James Nunn did with One Shot and what they've managed to achieve with only a $5 million budget is really impressive. What did you think of the
Well, I think, well, we're obviously going to get, before we get sort of stuck into One Shot, I mean, I guess sort of more broadly on the point of these types of films, I guess for some unknown reason, I am suspicious of filmmakers whenever they employ this type of gimmicks. And when I interrogate myself about why I feel that way, it is slightly unfair, because in other sort of artistic disciplines, I am much more comfortable with artists imposing those types of limitations on themselves. So, you know, I love music, and there are a lot of musicians who created projects which are, we're only going to use these types of instruments, or that, you know, they've imposed restrictions on themselves. You know, lots of artists we're only going to use these materials, we're only going to use these techniques in the artworks that we produce. And somehow I am more forgiving of them. I don't know, but when I hear of a filmmaker who is imposing, you know, sort of restrictions on themselves, my like pretension alert detector is immediately sort of, you know, ringing an alarm in my mind. And it's not without reason. You know, somebody like Hitchcock, I think one of the motivations of making Rope was actually that he was irritated by the fact that he wasn't seen as good as a technical, you know, he felt he was a, you know, a fantastically technical director, which, you know, I think history has proven himself, but he seemed to think that at the time that wasn't the way he was considered. So he wanted to do something that showed off his, you know, technical superiority. And so your motivations there are something other than telling the best story, which, you know, that's your ego getting in the way of potentially making the best type of film. So I'm perhaps not being fair on filmmakers, but yeah, I'm generally suspicious of them when they kind of start putting restrictions on themselves.
I think that's a good point. I think for me, it depends on the context. If you're Alejandro Iñárritu you know, you have a comfortable budget, or if you're Sam Mendes and you have massive budget and, you know, the best technicians in the film world, then, I mean, sure, the end result is impressive, but it's understandably impressive and expectedly, you know, it's expected that it's going to be impressive. But like when no-name filmmakers or DTV action filmmakers decide to do that, then I tend to try and go with an open mind and assume before thinking it's pretension, assume it's ambition rather than pretension, you know, which I prefer seeing in filmmakers. Lots of artists, as you said, regardless of the medium, like imposing restrictions on themselves. There's a very famous French novel that doesn't use the letter E, and the E is the most used letter in the French language. And it's like a crime drama, and you know, a full length novel, and the letter E never appears, and it's like insane because you're like, how can you write a novel without the letter E? And you know, the guy did it. It's like, oh, okay. So you know, it makes for interesting experiments. It can stay in history as well. I mean, Hitchcock, I think, wasn't a great fan of rope. He thought he shouldn't have done it. You know, later on, but he did do it, and you know, it's in the history books now. Sure, he wasn't trying to tell the best story. He was trying to prove a point, but his talent was such that I think it's still a vastly entertaining film, and a vastly interesting one in a technical sense. But like, there are, I know you like Bushwick. Sorry, I don't understand that film, but it's not an action film. It's not an action film that I want to mention, but it's a very little known film that I think should have more people watching it. It's called Fish and Cat. It's an Iranian film from 2013, and it is a real one take. There are no cuts in it at all. It's 135 minutes long, and it's like about a group of students camping at a lakeside, and people start showing up dead, and like the camera, you know, travels from character to character, and the director even manages, without any cuts, to make his film non-chronological.
Wow.
So yeah, there are flashbacks and flash forwards, because he uses the topography, he uses the location in such a smart way that he can twist his narrative like this. So we're in a forest, you know, and sometimes when we leave a character and we walk a bit, see another character, and then we find that character again, except something has changed on their clothes or the makeup, you know, something like that. And you understand that you're watching something that's like an hour ago, or, you know, 2 hours before the previous events and stuff like this. So that was very smart. That was a logistical triumph. And yeah, very, very little known film, but I thought I should mention it. There's also a real one take.
Wow,
Fish and Cat. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Not an action movie, no helicopters, but worth a watch.
Well, I definitely want to check that one out, so I'll be adding that to my watch list. But I think it's time we got stuck into one shot. So let's find out exactly when Mansoor arrived.
Mansoor arrived 10 days ago.
We the only ones out here?
Just us and our guests.
Cell in Europe has been trying to build a dirty bomb. We traced it to DC.
The detainees that come here do not depart until we've properly vetted.
Are you a mean man, sir?
That's been a terrible mistake. We screw up and one of these guys hurts the homeland, it's all over CNN.
Something's not right. On me.
Before we kick off, I need to issue a spoiler warning. So this is a still a fairly recent film. It's kind of just gone on Sky TV here in the UK, so appreciate some people might still be planning to watch this. So if you are and worried about spoilers, then you might want to come back to this podcast at a later date. But you know, I've given you your warning. Consider yourself warned. As for the plot, an elite squad of Navy SEALs are on a covert mission to transport a prisoner from a CIA island black site. He's wanted for interrogation as it's believed he's got vital information that can stop an imminent terrorist attack. As the SEALs are about to leave with their man, the prison is attacked by insurgents who are trying to rescue the prisoner to stop him revealing what he knows. In the lead role, we have one of the icons of DTV action, Scott Adkins. Alongside him, we have the one-time Hollywood hot prospect, Ryan Felipe, and Ashley Greene, who's best known for her role in the Twilight series. One Shot was directed by James Nunn, who's done a couple of the Marine sequels and also made Eliminators with Adkins. This film's got a 5.5 user rating on IMDb and a 3.2 user rating on Letterboxd. But with all of that out of the way, Alex, what did you make of One Shot?
There were several things I was worried about going in. First, it's not about Adkins. I know he can handle himself in the acting departments, but I was thinking, you know, when you have that kind of narrative and there is no breathing space for the director to cut away from a bad, you know, a bad actor, like a bad take, all the actors need to, you know, deliver. If it weren't for the actor who plays the prisoner, Waleed El-Gadi, if it weren't for his ability to sell his character, I think the film would collapse on itself. And like it doesn't. I think Waleed El-Gadi does, you know, a good job. Scott Adkins, yeah, good job. Okay, I like the man's work. I think like a lot of his fans. Some of my favorites are the Undisputed series. The more martial arts oriented films. So that's not the case with One Shot. It's more of a military action film with little hand-to-hand combat. So that's, you know, something to, like, if you're Scott Adkins, if you're a Scott Adkins fan and you want to see him fight, you know, just know that this film is mostly about military action and like tactical action and stuff like this, which, by the way, I thought was really good. I'm not an expert by any means, but from the you know, other movies I could compare it to, I thought this was really solid. And before we get too much into the action, I suppose a word on the story, which I thought the story was okay. It's nothing to write home about, like, but it's very
it's very generic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very generic. Nothing surprising in the story, but I think it serves its purpose. Like, it's for the narrative one shot, you know, one take device to work. I think you need a streamlined story, you know, easy to follow narrative. Otherwise, you might be, it's already a bit distracting. I thought for me, like the one take style was already a bit distracting in and of itself. So if the script had been more more complex or, you know, harder to follow, maybe it would have taken me out of the film entirely. So look, can't really sing praises about the script, but I think the one good thing about it is that it does make sense to keep all of the action in that one location. And like, it doesn't require too much suspension of disbelief to make us buy the fact that this is a one location film.
No, I'd be inclined to agree with you, because there's enough complexity with how they're making the film that if they're then telling a complicated story, then it'll probably break the filmmakers and break the actors if there was a more sort of complex story to tell. And I think it really helps the film. Well, helps, given that the technique that they're employing, it really helps that the action is set within a confined space. But yeah, more broadly, there was quite a lot of hype about this film, like, before it came out, and for me, it absolutely sort of lived up to the hype. I mean, I think it's a terrific movie. I think you can't give James Nunn too much credit for what he's pulled off here, because, you know, as you're watching it, like, the choreography of what you're seeing on screen is really impressive. Like, what's going on in the foreground, what's going on in the background. I mean, it is a sort of, I mean, I've never made a movie, but I know enough about how movies are made to watch this and to be able to realize just what a undertaking it is to do this movie. And I've kind of seen this now three times, and each time I've kind of started it watching it, right, I'm going to pay attention to the sort of like the technical aspects of the film. But quite quickly, after about 20-25 minutes, I find I'm just sort of drawn into just enjoying the experience of watching this film and just going with it, rather than sort of keeping that sort of analytical eye on the film, because I'm just enjoying it. I'm immersed in the action and I just want to experience it from that perspective. And so, yeah, overall, I was really impressed by One Shot and thoroughly enjoyed this film.
When a filmmaker decides to do like a movie like this with this in this style, you know, they always have to ask themselves, does it make sense to tell the story like this? And I think in terms of experience, viewer experience, it makes enough sense here, you know, to be justifiable. I don't think it's particularly, I don't think like it would massively change anything if you had a few cuts in there. But I have to, I have to admire the logistical success and how the camera is able to switch between groups of characters. So we go from Atkins and his soldiers to the mercenaries, the terrorists that are trying to capture the prisoner. And that's, it's a good thing that we get change of sceneries like this, as opposed to staying with Atkins the whole time. That, that brings a variety to the scenes. That's welcome. Now, there are moments where the one-shot technique, I think, is a detriment to the film, and it kind of takes me out. So, for instance, like, it's small details, but it's enough to call too much attention to itself. Like, for instance, at some stage, Atkins' character is on his own, and he's going, I think, to the comms room. He's going back to the comms room, and he wants to either send a message or, I don't remember, get some information. And so he's walking on his own and the camera is following from behind, and he enters the comms room and starts typing on the computer, and the camera goes around him. Like in a traditional film, you'd have a cut and you'd have the reverse shot of Atkins. You'd see his face typing on the computer. But here the camera has to go around a pillar that's, in the way. And then it provides the reverse shot. And so it takes maybe like between 5 and 10 seconds, to get from the back of Atkins to the, a front shot of him. And, in those moments, that takes me out, because I can see the cinematic device being deployed. And in that moment, precisely, there's no reason for it. Because it's not immersive. It's the opposite, but because the camera is not a character, then I think it poses problems in a few scenes like this. It's not like a major problem. Like it doesn't, it doesn't prevent me from enjoying the movie. But there are moments like this when I'm like, I would have preferred a cut there,
Yeah, I mean the only other moment that really that I bumped on when I was watching this film was, I guess it's the number of terrorists, insurgents, or mercenaries, whatever we want to call them, who are assaulting this particular compound. Because at the beginning of the film, we see this lorry arrive and it bursts through the gates, and then like a bunch of mercenaries, jump out of the back, and the battle is joined at that particular moment. Now, I personally haven't counted the number of dead bodies in this film, but somebody on the internet has documented Atkins' kill count in One Shot, and he is responsible for killing 59 people in this movie. And there is, there is no way there are that many people able to fit into the back of the lorry. Now, apparently,
I thought there were two trucks, no, in the beginning.
Yes, well, apparently there is, but you don't see that initially, but apparently on some later scene on a monitor, there is a second truck that you see like arriving at the gates on the monitor. So that is the sort of the justification for the number of like opponents that there are to face. But I, as I mentioned earlier, I've seen this film three times, and I've missed that particular detail on every occasion. So that was, I mean, credit to the filmmakers. They've kind of they found a way to weave it in, but it's so discreet that even on multiple rewatches, I failed to spot it. But I feel a bit nitpicky, frankly, sort of mentioning some of these things, because overall, this film is really successful in what it is setting out to do. And these issues, certainly that I've highlighted, they really don't get in the way of me enjoying this film. And they're certainly not things that I'm marking the film down for.
I think it's also a trope, you know, of those kind of action movies where the hero is able to take down several dozens of opponents, and we get the reward at the end with the fight against the head of the mercenaries. Do you want to say a few words actually about Jesse Liaudin, the actor who plays the big
bad? Yeah, go for it. The floor is yours.
It's just that. I'd never seen him before in a movie. I knew that guy, so he was born in France, and he's a very like accomplished martial artist, and he was in the UFC, you know, doing tournaments, and very impressive fighter. And actually, maybe I didn't recognize him in the trailer, you know, but when I was watching the film, I was like, oh, it's that guy. I was like, no, a very pleasant surprise.
He's got a very good screen presence, hasn't he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's very imposing, you know, like I wouldn't even want to say lines, you know, with him, because I'd be like, yeah.
I wouldn't be picking holes in one shot in front of him. Let's put it that way.
Exactly. but no, like, so obviously it's not really a spoiler, but him and Atkins fight, you know, at the end of the film. And so I think the action choreographer here was Tim Mann, who has collaborated with Atkins on a number of occasions before, and who's a regular of DTV Actioners. So I think everybody did a pretty good job here for the final fight, which is quite brutal and quite engaging, actually, I thought, you know, because after so many gun kills, it was refreshing to have an extended hand-to-hand combat scene. Definitely. So yeah, it's a really, 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 really good scene here at the end.
Yeah, but we kind of have just been chatting about some of, I guess, the weaker moments of the film in terms of the style that it's employing. But let's just flip that around. I mean, and just kind of pick out some of the bits where we feel that the technique was employed like much more successfully. And yes, we kind of mentioned it a little bit as we've been talking. I think the opening encounter after these mercenaries like bust into this prison site, I think the opening encounter between like the troops that are defending it and those and the villains or the attackers, I think is absolutely fantastic. The choreography there is really, really impressive. As I mentioned earlier, what's going on in the foreground, what's going on in the background, and I think, as you mentioned, the fact that the camera, you know, one part of that sequence, the camera is following Atkins and his men, and then it like follows the action round, and then it's the camera is following and telling the story of the mercenaries who are attacking the compound. And it's just a really, I thought that was one of the most, for me, one of the most like impressive sequences within the whole film.
Yeah, I agree. It was really well used here. I thought the scene where the technique was the most impressive was, so it's towards the end. Atkins is the last man standing, but he still has to face maybe 15 or so terrorists, and he's kind of playing a game of cat and mouse,
yeah,
with the terrorist. Technique is great because it really immerses you into that moment where Atkins is just trying to
just desperately avoid, stay alive.
Yeah, stay alive and avoid being seen by the terrorists, and you know, try to take them one by one. I thought that was a great use of the technique there.
Well, there are a few dramatic moments within the story that's being told here, in amongst all of the action. You know, how did they work for you? I mean, for myself, I actually think they managed to weave those like dramatic moments into the film quite well. So within the story they're telling, there is this mystery about the Mansur character, and we kind of like learn there's little bits of exposition as we go along, and which influence whether we think he's innocent, whether we think he's hiding something. And I think for the most part, actually, they managed that really well. And yeah, I wondered sort of, you know, we talked a lot about the action. I wondered what you made of the sort of the more dramatic moments that there are within the film here.
As I said, I really liked Walid El-Ghadi's character. Thought played it very well, and it's written well enough for it to work. Ryan Phillippe's character was a bit over the top, I thought. Mm. And he's, you know, he's made to be unlikable, and it's very obvious in the writing. And there's also, you know, small details like Ashley Green's character, for instance. I think she drops an echogram in the very first scene, you know, on the floor, which is a bit like...
It's Chekhov's MRI scan or like Chekhov's.
Yeah, exactly.
That's quite cleverly done, because you think one thing and then it turns out to have a different importance. So I did sort of roll my eyes a little bit, but the film did a little neat switcheroo with that I kind of redeemed it.
Yeah, the film knows we rolled our eyes and we're like, yeah, so this is not what you thought it was, yeah. Okay, yeah, I think the dramatic scenes were fine. You don't get that many, and I thought they were in line with the overall writing of the film, in that they were, you know, they served their purpose, and they served it well without it being the main focus point, you know.
Well, let's talk about the star of this film. And I think it's fair to say there's a lot of love out there for Scott Adkins on Action Twitter. So, you know, I think from what you've, you know, been saying already, are you a fan of his films and his work?
Yeah, absolutely. It took me a little while to discover him. And I think it was around Undisputed 3. Yeah, I think it was Undisputed 3 where... I was fully exposed to Scott Adkins' talent. And so, yeah, since I've been trying to catch up with his filmography, I haven't seen everything, you know, by a long shot. But I'm definitely a big, big fan of a couple of his movies, like the Undisputed franchise, Universal Soldier.
What about the ninja ones? I would have thought they'd be up your alley.
Yeah, no, they are. I don't know. Maybe I'm not gonna make friends. But Isaac Florentin is the director of the ninja movies. I just have trouble sometimes with his filmmaking. I just don't find it as solid or gripping as JCV Johnson's or James Nunn's. So the second one definitely is better than the first one, but even the second one, I see too many things that kind of bother me in the filmmaking, which is weird because two of the Undisputed movies are from that director as well. But I thought it's just the style of the tournament style. Of those movies suited him perfectly, because as soon as he's trying to weave a different narrative around the characters in the ninja movies, I think it all kind of falls apart. Whereas the Undisputed movies have this kind of condensed, focused narrative that works really well. But like, the problem for me in the ninja movies is that around the action, there's really nothing I can find of interest. I'm a huge Troyarch fan, so obviously I like Scott Adkins in Black Mask 2. It's not everyone's cup of tea, but it's Adkins's best comic book villain. I say it like that. Mustache twirling comic book villain. That was a long time ago now. So it's mostly dudes. I think I like Accident Man. Triple Threat was quite enjoyable. Ip Man 4 was very like wasn't very a nuanced character, to say the least. But like I think he did a good job on the action side of it, you know. I'm always looking forward to new Scott Adkins movies. There are some that I watch and I'll forget instantly. But like really looking forward to you know, Accident Man 2, and he'll be in John Wick 4 next year, unfortunately. But yeah.
So we got some good Scott Adkins to look forward to, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. The Debt Collector movies are good. They're great fun.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. They're very simple and very straightforward, but there's some really good stuff going on within those films. Like is it Lewis Mandalore as the sort of the Scott Adkins psychic in those movies? He brings a lot of personality to the films, which I think really sort of
I love Mandalore in those films. I think he was born to play this character. Yeah. I don't think I've ever enjoyed him more than in those two films. Yeah.
Okay, I think we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding helicopter action.
From Hollywood Pictures, con man Jimmy Dworsky has found businessman Spencer Barnes' date book.
My life is in there!
Now Jimmy's taking over Spencer's life.
I'm on Dynasty!
He's moving into his house.
Nice place.
Wearing his clothes.
Yes, sir!
And he's even using Spencer's name.
You must be Spencer.
Thank you, God.
Want to join me?
Sure. This is a disaster.
James Belushi, Charles Grodin, taking care of business.
I don't know who I am.
Rated R. National sneak preview this Sunday night.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. This occurs early in the film. The SEAL team have collected the prisoner and are about to fly out in a helicopter when the prison comes under attack. A gun battle breaks out between the SEALs, the prison guards, and the insurgents. During this exchange, an RPG is fired at the helicopter, causing it to explode. So, Alex, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
It's very quick, isn't it?
It certainly is, yes.
It's not a highlight of the film, no.
Sadly not.
No. I think it's safe to say so the helicopter is real, but it's safe to say that the explosion around it is completely CGI. Or maybe not at least, but that's how it seemed to me, because the shot is extremely quick. It doesn't stay on the helicopter because, you know, the camera keeps moving around to follow the characters. So, Will, I don't have much to say about that exploding helicopter.
Yeah, I mean, it is, frankly, a bit of a disappointment. But amidst a film as good as this, I can forgive it. But the exploding helicopter, sadly, is not amongst the highlights. I mean, there were a few things. You know, the explosion is not particularly great. We, you know, it sort of goes off and we see that it's damaged. Later on in the film, the sort of the action circles back round to the helicopter, and it does seem as if the helicopter is now a bit more burnt out. But sadly, we don't see how it arrived at that particular state. I mean, there were a few details that I did enjoy about this particular exploding helicopter. I did enjoy that it was a British helicopter that we see getting blown up here. It's a Lynx helicopter, which is typically used by the British military. But I always enjoy an exploding helicopter where somebody sounds the alarm by yelling RPG.
Yeah, I think logistically speaking, they just couldn't do it any other way, because how do you go from an intact helicopter to a blown up one without cutting? I don't see how it would be possible. It's not like you can turn the camera around and someone is coming to replace the helicopter while you're not with the budget these guys are working on. Yeah, I think it's a serviceable scene or moment in the scene, but it's certainly not a focus point.
But, you know, it's always, you know, I enjoyed the sort of importance that helicopters play in this film, because obviously the SEAL team arrive in a helicopter. You know, their escape is thwarted by the destruction of that particular helicopter. And then later on in the film, they are saved by the arrival of reinforcements who come in a helicopter. So, you know, I always enjoy a film where, you know, helicopters, are central to the action that we see in the film. Sadly, in this occasion, the quality of the exploding helicopter was in inverse proportion to the quality of the overall film. So I think that, that's a bit of a disappointment. I think overall, there's too much to enjoy here. So it's, it's nice to see an exploding helicopter in a film that this good, even if that particular chopper fireball isn't the most impressive. But, I think we can probably wrap things up for this show. Alex, thanks for joining me once again. Do you want to take a moment to tell people where they can find you online and what you get up to?
Sure. I try to be every day a little bit on Twitter at Head Exposure. So I try to share nice films that I stumble upon in my ongoing cinematic journey. And also, I kind of have a YouTube channel that I haven't done anything on it for a while, but it's not dead. Like, I'm still planning on doing stuff. I just haven't had the time lately. The YouTube channel is Kid Emotions. And the idea is that I try to take a particular fight scene and, take it apart shot by shot to understand why it's so great. I'll never make a video about why a scene is not good because, I don't have enough time in my life to focus on stuff I don't like. So I only talk about stuff I like. So yeah, there's that. Yeah, that's Kid Emotions on YouTube. And I'll try to make new videos this year as soon as I have enough time. And it was a pleasure to be on the show, Will. Thank you.
No, it was a pleasure to have you back. And I'll just say that, it's Alex's, Twitter feed is an absolutely essential follow. Yeah, go and check out his video essays, like breaking down particular action scenes. It's definitely worth the investment of your time. Something else that is worth the investment of your time is the Exploding Helicopter website, which you can find at explodinghelicopter.com for more reviews and facts about how helicopters keep exploding in films.
My favorite website.
the checks in the post, Alex. We'll be back soon, but until then, keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.